This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley of TVWorthWatching.com, sitting in for Terry Gross. Our first guest today, continuing our week-long celebration of country music, is Doc Watson, one of America's most revered folk musicians. For much of his career, he performed and toured with his son, Merle. Merle died in 1985 in a farm accident, just days before Fretz magazine named him finger-picking guitarist of the year in folk, blues, or country music. An annual concert in North Carolina honoring Merle, called Merle Fest, wrapped up a few weeks ago. We'll listen to Terry's 1988 interview with Doc and hear some songs recorded in 1989 in our studio. Let's begin with an excerpt from that Fresh Air concert with Doc Watson and his longtime duets partner, guitarist Jack Lawrence.
I want to welcome both of you to Fresh Air, and Doc Watson, can I ask you to introduce the first song?
Thank you, Terry. I think we'll do one that Merle and I, my son Merle and I, learned from John Hurt. A good old tune called Make Me Down a Pallet on Your Floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down, make it soft and low. And then maybe my good gal, she won't know. I'm going up the country through that sleet and snow. Going up the country through that sleet and snow. Yes, I'm going up the country through that sleet and snow. Ain't no telling just how far I'll go. Getting my breakfast here and my dinner in Tennessee. Get breakfast here and dinner in Tennessee. Gonna get my breakfast here, my dinner in Tennessee. Told you I was coming, so you better look for me. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down, make it soft and low. Then maybe my good gal, she won't know. What do you think about it, Jack? Yeah, I like that notion right there. Well, you know that I can't lay down on your bed. Now, honey, I can't lay down on your bed. No, baby, can't lay down across that pretty bed. Cause my good woman, she might kill me dead. And don't you let my good gal catch you here. Hey, don't you let my good gal catch you here. If you do, she may shoot you. She might cut and stab you too. Ain't no telling what that gal might do. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down? Make it soft and low. Then maybe my good gal, she won't know. The way I've been sleeping, my back and shoulders tired. The way I've been sleeping, my back and shoulders tired. Yeah, the way I've been sleeping, my back and shoulders tired. I think I'll turn and try sleeping on my side. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, won't you make it down, make it soft and low. And then maybe my good gal, she won't know. Let's play some country counterpoint, son. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Make me down a pallet on your floor. Honey, make it over. Close behind that door. Make it where your good man will never go.
All right.
Doc Watson with guitarist Jack Lawrence in our studio in 1989. Watson was born in Deep Gap, North Carolina, and went blind after an eye infection around his first birthday. His father was a musician, although not a professional performer. But he introduced Doc to playing by making him his first banjo, as Doc Watson told Terry in 1988.
That was in the summer of 1934. Made my first little stringed instrument. I had a harmonica before that. But Dad showed me a few of the old-time Fralin or Clawhammer banjo-style tunes, and one day he brought it to me and put it in my hands and said, "Son, I want you to learn to play this thing real well. Some of these days we'll get you a better one." He said, "Might help you get through the world."
And what was it like for you the first time you got the banjo into your hands? What did you do with it?
I remember how I felt, but I don't remember hardly what it was like learning the first tunes. It was kind of hard for Dad to show me because I couldn't see his hands. But he finally got across to me how to do the licks on the banjo and how to note the thing. And I could figure out where the notes were because it was fretless. And you could slide along with your fingers, and finally you come to the right one, you know, and you found out how to get there without missing them.
So you were really pretty self-taught.
For the most part, yes, I was. The guitar, absolutely, I was self-taught.
How did you get your first guitar?
One spring, my dad told my youngest brother and I, "Boys, if you'll cut all those dead chestnut, small dead chestnuts down along the road and around the edge of the field there, you can sell it for pulpwood to the tannery." And we went at it, and we cut a couple of big truckloads. It didn't make us a mint of money, but it made me enough to buy me a good little guitar from, well, I thought it was good at the time, from Sears Roebuck, and my younger brother ordered him a suit of clothes.
Now, considering that your early instruments were homemade banjos and a mail-order guitar, did you ever get really obsessed with the quality of instruments that you were playing? Some musicians just play what they have, and others get really obsessed with having instruments that are just right for them or custom-made for them.
I was fairly contented with what I had. I never had had my hands on a good guitar back in those days and didn't for years. The first good guitar that I got hold of that I would have considered much better than my mail order box was a Martin guitar that Richard Green used to have a little music store under his, he had a boarding house or an inn there in Boone. And I went in there one day with that little mail order thing and he said, "Why don't you let me help you get you a good guitar?" And I said, "Gosh, it costs too much." And he said, "I'll tell you what I can do. I can get you a good Martin D18 that will be a price that you can afford, and I'll take the payments down to $5 a month." And I couldn't beat that. I paid it off quicker than that, but I couldn't beat that with a stick. And at that time, I was playing at the little fruit stand and a little bean market they had in Boone and making me a few shekels on Saturday, having a good time of picking, and I paid for the guitar that summer. He got me that thing at his cost, and it cost $90. Oh, Lord, I was proud of that guitar. But in all truth, compared to my guitar now, it was like fretting a fence. It was really hard to play.
Well, I guess it's almost good in a way to get used to something like that, because it makes it seem so much easier when you get a good guitar.
Oh, it really does. And when I got into the folk revival in the 60s, I ran into people who could set a guitar action up to where you could play it, and I came on to another Martin along about that time. Played a Gibson at first on the road, borrowed. Then I came into another Martin, and the action was brought down to where you could play it.
My guest is Doc Watson. You know, I'm glad you brought up the folk revival. It was really during the folk revival that you started to become nationally known. I think you'd been playing dances and you know, playing
played
in
rockabilly
your area.
Music through the 50s and played an electric guitar, Les Paul.
Well, see, this really interests me. You were playing rockabilly and an electric guitar.
Mm-hmm. And rockabilly and old pop standards with an old boy named Jack Williams. Jack had a little group together, and when he heard me pick, he said, "Buddy, I want you to pick with me."
Well, I want to play something that was recorded by Ralph Rinsler. Ralph Rinsler recorded it. You were performing
in my living room. In my living room, yeah.
Okay, so from the early 1960s, this is my guest, Doc Watson.
Now John come home, all in a wonder. He rattled at the door just like thunder. "Who is that, Mr. Henley?" cried. "'Tis my husband you must hire." down, sit down by the fireside weeping, and up that chimney he got to peeping. There he saw that poor old soul setting up a straddle of the pot rack pole. Then John built on a rousing fire just to suit his own desire. His wife got out with a free goodwill. Don't do that for the man you'll kill. John ranged up and down, he fetched him like a coon when a dog had catched him. He blacked his eyes and then did better, kicked him out right on his setter. Then his wife, she crawled in under the bed, and he pulled her out by the hair of the head. And when I'm gone, remember then, he kicked her where the chinches had been. Law went down and John went up. He didn't have the chance of a yaller pup. They sent him down to the old chain gang for beating his wife with a dear little thing. Well, John didn't worry, but John didn't cry, but when he got back home, he socked her an eye. They took him right back to the old town jail, but his wife got lonesome and she paid his bail. Judge sent back, made him work so hard, he longed to be home in his own front yard. They kept him there and wouldn't turn him loose. I could tell you more about him, but there ain't no use.
Once you went on the road during the folk revival, now you weren't used to traveling. There must have been a lot you learned how to learn how to do. Did you have a business manager to help you out with bookings? And
Ralph Rensler did the bookings between he and Manny Greenhill of Folklore Productions. But Ralph traveled a lot with me, and if he didn't, when I went go to New York to work in the city, I came by Trailways bus. Someone would always meet me at the Port Authority and take me over to Ralph's apartment. I worked lots of times. I'd work at Gertie's Folk City a week or 2 weeks at a time, doing either opening act or just playing the job straight there. It was scary. I was as green as a green apple as far as the city. Country boy, you really
are. Oh, yeah, sure.
As the old-timers used to say, a hayseed for sure.
You know, I think there's always clubs who, maybe not many, but there's always some clubs willing to take advantage of a performer. And I would guess that someone who was blind was a more likely target if they didn't have people who were watching out for them. Would you ever have any problems with that?
I was glad when my son Merle started on the road with me, because if we went to a place and they didn't treat me too good, Dad, we won't come back here no more. And that was the end of it. We didn't hit too many places that they weren't really decent to us, but once in a great while there, of course I won't call any names because we're on nationwide radio, but we were in a few places where they treated you like pieces of used equipment, and that was the end of playing there. We just didn't do it again. That's the best thing you can do, you know, is not tolerate that. Just move away.
You mentioned your son Merle. Did you teach him how to play guitar?
No. Merle didn't show any interest in the guitar until he was 15. I was on my first concert tour. It was a little solo concert tour that spring. And about middle ways of it, Ralph called me and said, Doc, I've got some good news. And I said, well, lay it on me. And he said, Merle has started playing the guitar. His mother, Rosalie, started him on the guitar. She taught him his first chords and showed him how to play them and a little bit about timing, and he just took it and went with it. And we met John Hurt for the first time that same summer. We went to the Berkeley Folk Festival, and Merle played backup guitar for me. He'd only been playing about 3 months. And he played backup guitar on the stage, and when we met John Hurt, Merle was enthralled by John's finger style on the guitar. And he took that and added a few little notions of his own, and that's where Merle's finger style came from.
So he never felt that he had to work hard to differentiate his style from your style?
Merle, once in a while he'd ask me for some pointers on a melody to a song or something, but Merle played his very own thing on the guitar. I don't think he even ever asked me how to hold the pick. He probably looked at the way I held it. But I never really sat down and taught him how you get this note or that note. I just played a song and sang it, and he jumped in there and learned the lead to it.
When your son Merle died, was it hard for you to go back on the road afterwards?
if you'll pardon a little intimacy here, I'll tell you something that happened or I wouldn't have. Between the time he was killed and his funeral, I dreamed I was in a dark desert, and it was so hot you couldn't breathe. And the sand was pulling me down like if you were in quicksand. And that big, strong hand reached back and said, "Come on, Dad, you can make it." And he brought me, led me out to where it was cool, but there was sunny, but there was a cool breeze. And I waked up and I thought, well, I'll try. And I took up the last job on that particular tour that we'd canceled. And my friend Jack Lawrence had been working some while Merle was off the road with us for quite a while. And Jack stayed on as the other guitarist. And I'm kind of glad I did. If I had stayed off the road a month, I never would have come back. It was so hard, you know. You couldn't know, Terry, but it was really hard to go back out there without him.
But I guess that dream kind of gave you permission in a way to do it.
I believe it was godsend, I think, the dream was.
Doc Watson speaking to Terry Gross in 1988. Watson is now 87 years old and still performs occasionally. We'll conclude this half hour by returning to the 1989 Fresh Air Studio concert performance by Doc Watson featuring his longtime duets partner, guitarist Jack Lawrence. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Here's a little tune about an old boy that, that decided he's going to leave home and learn to travel. And he found a pretty little girl and got married and got two for the price of one. And I'll let the song tell you the rest of the tale. It's called Give Me Back My 15 Cents. I left my home in Tennessee and I thought I'd learn to travel. But then I met with a pretty little gal and soon we played the devil. I loved that gal and she loved me and I thought we'd live together. But then we tied that fatal knot and now I'm gone forever. Give me back my 15 cents, give me back my money. Give me back my 15 cents and I'll go home to Manny. Yeah, let me hear your opinion. Twas 15 cents to the preacher man and a dollar for the paper. Then dear old mother-in-law moved in and lordy, what a caper. I fiddled a tune for her one day and she called me a joker. Then that old sow got mad at me and hit me with the poker. Give me back my 15 cents, give me back my money. Give me back my 15 cents and I'll go home to Mammy. Town and I worked on the farm, but there was no way to suit them. They're both so dad burned mean to me, somebody ought to shoot them. I'm tired of looking at my mother-in-law. I'd like to see my granny. Gonna leave the state of Arkansas and go back home to Mammy. Give me back my 15 cents, give me back my money. Give me back my 15 cents and I'll go home to Mammy. Yeah. Jack, I think a good old train song might be in order right here. Son, I remember that song over there that Brother Jimmy Jett wrote. And I'm going to plug an album right here. I ain't supposed to do this, but it's on an album I did for Sugar Hill called Riding the Midnight Train, a bluegrass album, my first endeavor on pure bluegrass. Greenville Trussle is a song for the train buffs that love the good old steam engine sounds and all that good. I remember when I went to school at Raleigh, there was a train went by every 20 minutes on an average. And this song makes me think of those days. Mm-hmm. remember as a boy how in wonderment and joy I'd watch the trains as they'd go by. And the whistle's lonesome sound you could hear for miles around as they rolled across that Greenville trestle high. But the whistles don't sound like they used to. Lately, not many trains go by. Hard times across this land mean no work for a railroad man. And the Greenville trestle now don't seem so high.
Thank you, son.
This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bean Cooley, sitting in for Terry Gross. In this week celebrating country music, our next guests certainly qualify for inclusion, but they represent a slightly different tradition. They play string and jug band music of the 1920s and 30s, music most people associate with a white Southern tradition. But our guests are African American and see themselves as part of a little-known black string band tradition. Their band is called the Carolina Chocolate Drops. Their latest CD is called Genuine Negro Jig, and they also have a new songbook. The band members are in their 20s and early 30s, and they're not trying to sound like they're old-timers. They all play several instruments and sing. Rhiannon Giddens plays five-string banjo, fiddle, and kazoo. Dom Flemons plays guitar, four-string banjo, harmonica, jug, snare drum, and bones. Justin Robinson plays fiddle, auto harp, and does the vocal beatbox. They all live in North Carolina, as the band's title suggests, but Flemons grew up in Arizona. Terry spoke with them earlier this year, and they brought some of their instruments to the WUNC studio in Durham for the interview.
Rhiannon Giddens, Justin Robinson, Dom Flemons, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me start by asking you to perform a song that's also featured on the new CD. Can you do Your Baby and Sweet Like Mine for us?
Absolutely.
Everybody talking about the sweetie nowadays. I got the one with the sweetest ways. Your baby may roll a jelly fine. Nobody's baby can roll it like mine. Your baby ain't sweet like mine. She bake a jelly roll all the time. And when I'm feeling lonesome and blue, my baby knows just what to do. Yes, she even called me honey. She even let me spend the money. Never has a baby put me out though. She even buys me all my clothes. I don't want to brag, just want to put you in line. Your baby ain't sweet like mine, no, no. Your baby ain't sweet like mine. Oh, play that old. Oh, play like Mr. Tom Lockie.
Fantastic. That's the Carolina Chocolate Drops, a song that they're performing for us, but that's a song they also do on their new CD, Genuine Negro Jig. String bands are usually considered a white Southern tradition, and you're a band of African-American musicians. And you've found a black string band tradition that you feel part of. But did you fall in love with this music before you knew that there was a black string band tradition?
Yep.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What did you fall in love with about it?
Well, I fell in love with the rhythm. I was a contra dancer and square dancer, and I just was seduced by the banjo, the rhythm of the clawhammer banjo. That just really pulled me in. And then I found out about the history, and then I went, oh, this is really deep. And then it just kind of, I was done. I was done for then. You know, that was it.
Now, part of the tricky aspect of string band music is that part of its roots are in minstrel shows, part of its roots are in blackface. And so it gets really kind of complicated when you go back to the early history of that music. So I wonder what it's been like for you to negotiate that aspect of the music and to deal with separating the music itself from some of the stereotypes that were foisted on the musicians who played it.
I think something that we have that as a new generation of player in the old time music is that we are educated and we're approaching the music at a emotional distance that just has not been there in earlier generations. Before, you'd look back at those aspects of history, and people just would say, don't touch that. That's the worst stuff in the world, and that's what's ruining the world. And now, in this generation, we're able to actually start piecing those things apart just because, we want to take the benefits and also try to make what's right or see what actually happened or what was misappropriate or what was good. Because the thing about a lot of the black string band music is not much of the music was put down on recording, and that's a very essential part of understanding black music is hearing it. And, you know, delving into it, you find some things that are off-putting, but at the same time, you got to think in the context of the past instead of thinking in the context of the present.
I'd like to ask you to perform another song that's also featured on the new CD, and the song is Trouble in Your Mind. So before you play it for us, tell us why you chose it and what you love about the song.
Well, this is one that Justin was playing that I reminded him one day at a jam that he played it, and it's a piece from an album called Music from the Lost Provinces, put out by Old Hat Records, and it's just a nice breakdown, and we just started doing it.
Okay, let's hear it.
I wish I had a nickel, I wish I had a dime, I wish I had me a pretty girl, you know I'd call her mine. Don't get trouble in your mind, don't get trouble in your mind. Don't get trouble in your mind, don't get trouble in your mind. If you see that gal of mine, you tell her if you can. For she goes to make my bread, washing at your hand. Don't get trouble in your mind, don't get trouble in your mind. Don't get trouble in your mind, don't get trouble in your mind.
So we were talking about how you discovered like the African American tradition in string bands, and you met an African American fiddler who's in his 90s now, named Joe Thompson. Yeah. And did he teach you certain things on fiddle that you didn't know or hadn't heard before?
Oh Lord, yeah. Joe Thompson is the guy that you were mentioning. He's 91. He's been playing since he was 6 or 7 years old, and he learned from his father, and his father learned from his father. So it's a long tradition among his family.
The kind of amazing thing is that one of the reasons why I think our sound is the way it is that we were all sort of learning when we started going down to play with Joe, so we didn't get much chance to play other sort of more, I don't know, square? I don't know, so different ways. But what the one of the things that I think I've taken away a lot as a banjo player is, I'll get the banjo here, is that the... real heavy down, the downstroke, you know, the it's and it's almost an anticipatory kind of down, you know, if that makes sense. I don't know, it's kind of hard to talk about music, but
well, a lot of times you tend to hear that with hillbilly performers more in like the style of like Grandpa Jones or Uncle Dave Macon generally, but even that Tennessee style, that's taken to an extreme. While North Carolina, it's a little bit more, it's a little bit more compact within it, but the downbeat is still there.
Justin, is there anything you could talk about that you learned from Joe Thompson on fiddle?
Oh yeah. Well, first of all, Joe's bowing is really, really interesting. He has a which is something that's common among fiddle players, at least around here, something they call the double shuffle. Or some people call it hen's egg. I've heard fiddlers call it sewing cloth. It's all this sort of forward and back motion that is going forward all at the same time and making these really great rhythmic kind of things that you have to really work very hard to get. And also, Joe plays notes that are not in the Western scale, which is actually kind of great.
Can you play us an example of what you're talking about?
Oh, I'll play you the double shuffle.
What makes that the double shuffle? Is it the speed or the harmony?
I'll play it without the double shuffle, and then she'll hear it.
So this is without it. So it's a little of both, because of the way that the fiddle is tuned. When you're playing the double shuffle, you get to get these really either sympathetic ringing strings or, depending on where your fingers are, not sympathetic ringing. So you get some really interesting harmonies that I've never really heard anywhere else in any other kind of music.
Well, you know, we're talking about rescuing music from the past, but you're also playing music from the present as well as original songs, and I think we should get to that a little bit. Although you're doing this contemporary music in the spirit of the string band style. So, Rhiannon, onto a song that you do on the new CD, and this is a song that I want you to talk about. I want you to talk about the original version and how you heard it and why you do it, and it's Hit 'Em Up Style.
Yeah, Hit 'Em Up Style is, well, it was really popular, and I happened to be listening to pop radio at the time. I don't really much now anymore, but it was just all over the radio, and every time it came on, I would just, like, jam in my car to it. It just was very catchy and had a great chorus and, you know, beats and all that stuff, and it's just one of those songs that kind of never went away in my brain, and then I heard it again on the radio, like, years later, and just something kind of occurred to me. I was like, I wonder if we could try to play that. And so I tried to play it on the fiddle, and it actually worked really well on the fiddle. And then the three of us sort of came together and said, okay, like, how could we do this? And then, you know, Dom came up with a great rhythm on the banjo that worked really well. And then we found out that Justin beatboxed, and we're like, you know, and then it just clicked. And we kind of messed around with the original version of the song. We just tossed out what didn't work and just kind of went with what did.
And who did the original?
Blue Cantrell was the original singer, yeah.
Okay, so let's hear this from the CD. This is from the Carolina Chocolate Drops new CD, Genuine Negro Jig. And this is Rhiannon Giddens singing lead.
I was beaming in his beamer, just beaming. Can't believe that I caught my man cheating. So I found another way to make him pay for it all. So I went Marcus on a shopping spree, and on the way grab Soleil and Mia, and as the cash box rang I threw everything away. Your hands on his cash and spend it to the last time for all the hard times. When you go, then everything goes from the crib to the ride in the clothes. So you better let him know that if he messes up, you gotta hit him up.
So that's Rhiannon Giddens singing from the new Carolina Chocolate Drops CD, Genuine Negro Jig. Nicely done. I really like that a lot. And Rhiannon, what you're playing on fiddle, it's this like drone style that I think is really interesting.
And yeah, it's just all kind of old-timey, you know, old-timey put to hip-hop, I suppose.
is that drone really old-timey, or is that a more contemporary kind of thing?
Oh, no, that's very old-timey. The double stopping, you know, that kind of rhythmic bowing, it's all old-timey. What makes it contemporary is the minor key, you know, because there's not a lot of minor stuff in those tunes. And, well, I mean, there are some, but the ones that we think of as old, you know, like that are in the public sort of ear are not in minor key, and I think that's one of the main things that makes it sound so contemporary and so kind of, you know, people say it's Middle Eastern-y. It's just, you know, it's in a minor key.
So how did you learn that drone style? Maybe you could just play a little bit of that drone and talk about it a little bit.
Oh, gosh. I mean, just from playing... That's just like one of the first old time tunes I knew, and so it wasn't much of a leap to take that to that tune, to the Hit 'Em Up style tune. It just fit really well.
Yeah, compare that to what you did on Hit 'Em Up style. Do a little bit of that. Now, were you classically trained on fiddle, on violin?
Oh, good Lord, no. No. Just voice.
Now, Dom, among the instruments you play are four-string banjo, bones, and jug. So you want to take out your jug for us?
Okay, here we have the jug. Okay. This is a big ceramic one.
You want to give us a demonstration of good jug technique?
All right, let's see. All right.
The Carolina Chocolate Drops, speaking to Terry Gross earlier this year. Their latest CD is called Genuine Negro Jig. Next, country music lyrics, specifically some of its more memorable puns. This is Fresh Air. Our linguist, Jeff Nunberg, is a country music fan. Besides the music, he loves the wordplay and especially the puns. Some people say the punning in country is the characteristic that makes it hard for them to take the music seriously. But Jeff says Shakespeare would have had no problem with it. We first aired this piece in 1999.
The best movie about country music I know of is a gritty little 1972 film called Payday. Rip Torn plays a fading second-tier country star touring the South from roadhouse to roadhouse on an out-of-control drunken binge. The movie's much more genuine than Robert Altman's overblown Nashville, which came out a few years later, and one reason is that it took pains to get the music right, both the best and worst of it. There's one scene in particular that sticks with me, When Torn's character is obliged to stand in a parking lot listening to a young dishwasher who wants to work as a country singer sing a composition called I'm Loving You More But Enjoying It Less. It's the perfect example of an awful country song from that period, down to its punning title. Pop singers like the Beatles and Elvis Costello may have visited wordplay from time to time, but country music lives there. A lot of it involves outright puns, like the Bellamy Brothers' If I Said You Had a Beautiful Body, Would You Hold It Against Me? Or Leanne Womack's Am I the Only Thing That You Done Wrong? There's Gary Nicholson's Behind Bars, which is about saloons, and Randy Travis's On the Other Hand, which is about wedding rings. And then there are all those other titles that involve wordplay of one sort or another, like Dolly Parton's It's All Wrong, But It's All Right, or Johnny Paycheck's I'm the Only Hell My Mama Ever Raised. When I think of songs like these, though, the singer that comes first to mind is George Jones. I don't know if he's done more of them than anybody else. The honors there probably go to Roger Miller or Johnny Paycheck. And a lot of the punning titles that Jones does are just routine joke songs, like She Took My Keys Away and Now She Won't Drive Me to Drink.
I saw those blue lights flashing over my left shoulder. He walked right up and said, get off that riding mower. I said, sir, let me explain before you put me in the tank. She took my keys away and now she won't drive me to drink.
But Jones has also made a specialty of using puns and wordplay in the plaintive ballads that he sings like no one else. There are songs like A Man Can Be a Drunk Sometimes, But a Drunk Can't Be a Man, or At Least I've Learned to Stand on My Own Two Knees, or the recent 100 Proof Memories.
Love on the rocks, that's all he said. As he sat there beside me, shaking his head, I said, mister, you look like you're taking it rough. The next round's on me, he said, I don't touch the stuff. Cause these 100-proof memories are stronger than wine. It don't take but one taste to send you out of your mind. No, I don't want the whiskey, but I could sure you. Lord, you don't think and drive.
For some people, of course, this sort of punning just confirms a sense of country music as a linguistic trailer park. Since Tennyson's time, punning has been deprecated as the basest form of humor, to the point where it's usually a kind of veiled aggressiveness nowadays. Habitual punsters live for groans the way violinists live for applause. Sophisticated people may make exceptions for the literary puns of Joyce or Nabokov or the urbane wordplay of 30s show tunes, but they have trouble finding a place for somebody who makes puns in earnest, particularly in a sentimental ballad. But maybe that's simply because most people have forgotten how to take puns seriously. The wordplay in Cole Porter or Nabokov is dazzling but usually superficial. The wordplay in country songs is pedestrian but sometimes profound. It has a rueful irony, as the innocent reading of an ordinary expression reveals a new meaning that makes it more sad and knowing. You think of Charlie Pride's She's Too Good to Be True, or George Jones' recent Tied to a Stone.
I woke up this morning and prayed to God, oh, let this be a dream. Her side of the bed was cold, and laying there beside me was her ring. With a note that she had left for me,
laying where she used to lay her head. And I felt the world falling on me, for this is what she said. Tied to a stone, ain't no way to live. I can't go on living like this.
It's a fitting device for these ballads, particularly when they're tackling their favorite themes, the fragility of happiness, the loss that's always imminent in love and family. There's a joke that sums up the genre very nicely. What do you get if you play a country song backwards? You get your wife back, you get your dog back, you get your truck back. And the sense of loss and estrangement is implicit in the language of the lyrics, too, as the ordinary expressions we use to talk about our lives break down to reveal darker meanings. It's a kind of wordplay with antique roots. It owes a lot to the language of sermons, particularly in the Baptist and evangelical traditions, with their attentiveness to the multiple meanings of scriptural passages. But it has earlier antecedents in the sermons and poetry of the metaphysical poets like John Donne and George Herbert. And even earlier than that, you can find its secular echoes in Shakespeare. Take Hamlet's bitter pun about his uncle, a little more than kin and less than kind. When you think about it, that would make a great George Jones title. Like Jones, Shakespeare knew that there was more to wordplay than just fooling around.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist who teaches at the School of Information at the University of California at Berkeley. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Bob Purdick, with additional engineering support from Joyce Lieberman and Julian Hirschfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Melody Kramer is our associate producer of online media. Sue Spolin directed the show. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.